Hello and welcome to episode 252 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and John Sills.
Oh, welcome back everybody, and here we are again, episode 252, as Matt has just reminded us. As it happens, when I joined this podcast recording, I spent a few minutes wondering where everybody was before realising I was on the link for 251. And then I realised, I'm sure we've done that episode before. So there we go, you know, it's very easy to make a mistake. Even when you're as practiced as we are. So Matt, how's your week been other than that kind of thing?
Well, I guess that's time travelling of a fashion, isn't it? My week has gone very well. The very exciting book launch that I was supposed to be going to last week, I wasn't able to make because I wasn't feeling very well, but we'll make up for that with this week's guest, which is very exciting. We went for a meal with some friends in Richmond, so we pretended that we were young, footloose and fancy free again, which is very nice. We had cocktails beforehand and dinner. That was good. I've continued. I'm now up to 27 of the 100 coffees. Definitely front loading it. Met with some very interesting characters today, I can tell you. So Chris and I caught up for a coffee. I haven't seen each other in person since November, have I? It was very nice to see you. And I have been doing work to be able to get some new pieces of work over the line, and all of the weird bureaucracy that seems to get between people saying, yes, let's do it, and everybody being contractually assured that they will do it. And I've got two going on at the same time, which is, yeah, I live for being able to do costings in spreadsheets. That's why I was put on this planet. But, you know, that's the way it goes. So, yeah, it's been an interesting week. How about you?
Well, it's been a long week, really, because this we're recording a slightly different day in the week, and therefore it's been a few days since the last time we did this. And it's been busy. And as much as I've been to London a few times, and I've been to Manchester, and I've been into Birmingham, and we did a social thing with work at Flight Club, you know, which is the way that we play darts. Which is a jolly good fun.
Hipster darts.
Well, you know, you say that, but this is Birmingham, right? It's not. There's no hipsters in Birmingham.
Reel it back in.
And then I went to a Midlands Tech Leaders thing on Thursday last week. So it's been, I think, hectic is the word I would use. But, you know, none the worse for that. Lots of meeting up with people that, like as you say, you haven't seen for a while, old friends and new friends and all that. So yes, all good fun.
Excellent. And John Sills, joining us this
Hello.
Week. Other than the book launch that I didn't make, for which I'm truly sorry, how's your week been?
Well, it's been good. I mean, the book launch was slightly sullied by the star guest not being there. So, you know, it was you know, not the peak of the week, I know. No, it's been a brilliant week. So, yeah, we've obviously had the book launch, which we may, I'm sure, talk about over the next half an hour or so. I had quite a fun weekend with some friends that came down, and I got to study. There were four children in the house between the ages of 4 and 14. So I got to study the impact of screen time or not with those children and what they're drawn to and what they're not. And then I had some various work things, but kind of slightly interesting but bizarre evening last night where I went to Wembley Arena to watch this thing called Young Voices that my 8-year-old was in, where they basically get a whole load of school choirs all together, and there was 5,000 children there, and they kind of set up Wembley Arena so the 5,000 children are all in the seats around the top, and they're kind of surrounding the adults in the middle, and then the orchestra and the conductor kind of almost baits the children, you know, to get them to yell at the adults for not being loud enough or not dancing enough. It's a very odd situation. And then Heather Small from M People turns up and sings a couple of songs, and all the grown-ups suddenly feel incredibly relaxed again and pretend they're 18 again. And then it was it, and that was over. And then I was home by 9:30. So it was a very, very bizarre night, but fun in its own way. And now I'm here.
Wow. I think I saw a friend of mine in Leeds or York or somewhere in Yorkshire who'd been to a very similar event in the last few days as well. So there's obviously some sort of scheme.
It's this time of year, and they move it around. They move it around the different places. So I knew Heather Small was going to be there because one of my friends had already broken the secret of Heather Small, Heather Small turning up. Although, funnily enough, well, it's not funny enough. It's probably incredibly boring, but she's taller than you think. I thought she was quite small. So afterwards we Googled, and she's actually 5'4", which is just below average. But yeah, it was a very bizarre the very bizarre situation all round, really. But yeah, I think it'll be all over the internet for the next couple of weeks as parents.
That sounds.
Put photos on of their children.
It sounds like, you know, being in the middle of a stadium surrounded by bellowing children. It sounds like the kind of thing you dream about after too much Gorgonzola. It's, you know, odd.
Yeah. It is very odd because also you have, like, they bring beatboxers on and street dancers on, and it's a bit like Lord of the Flies. You feel like you're in trouble here, and the kids have just kind of got the run of the place, and the teachers are kind of looking slightly worried with them, and they're all dressed in the same outfit. All 5,000 children in the same outfit.
Even worse.
So, and then near the end, they open the doors, and all the adults are allowed to escape, but they hold the children back. So, yeah, it was good fun.
Sorry, they still got your children?
Yeah, the children stay there, and then there's a race. So you then have to try and get back
before
the children are in coaches. So it's like one of those Top Gear races. Oh. The children are in coaches. You've got to try and make your way back on public transport and get back to the school to pick up your child before the child gets back to the school. Otherwise, well, I don't know what happens.
That sounds like an exercise in generating anxiety for just about everybody.
Everyone, the last 5 minutes of the concert, you've just got parents kind of getting there, wanting to show respect for their lovely children, but just getting their coats on, getting ready to run out, fighting onto the train as it turns up. You know, they've got kids, you've got parents that, honestly, on the train, they were, one parent said, "I've got a tracker, I've put a tracker in my son's pocket so I know where they are." And everyone was like, "Well, where's your kid at the moment? Like, he's still stuck in the car park." It was bizarre, but brilliant. They also had a great conversation on the train about Amazon Fresh. They've got one of those at Wembley, and then someone was said, "Have you just been to that Amazon place where you don't have to pick stuff up and pay?" And someone else said, "Yeah, I've just been there." And then like four or five people joined in, and everyone was like, "Well, how does it work? And it's the future, and I don't want my kids doing it because they're going to grow up to shoplift." And yeah, all kinds of conversations happened. So it was a revealing evening.
Sounds it, yeah. Jeff Bezos taking the fun out of shoplifting. I never really thought about Amazon Fresh quite in that context before.
Yeah.
Quite bizarre.
It's a place to practice.
Indeed. Anyway, well, yes, we are going to talk about your book this week, and a fascinating tome it is too, so I think we should probably crack on. So in preparing, and dear listener, I do sometimes prepare for this. In preparing for this, I was reminiscing about the fact that, John, you're the first person I think I ever saw pay for something in a shop or a restaurant or whatever with an Apple Watch. And so it was still in the early days of the NFC kind of payments through phones. And Apple had made the watch. And it was maybe about 8 years or so ago now, wasn't it? And we were in a pizza place in Soho. And you very generously went to pay. And then you came back to the table where we were sitting. And you said to me, "Did that make me look like a bit of a wanker?" To which I had to be honest and say, yes, it did. And there's a couple of things about that story that I find interesting. The first is, and it's something that I've explored quite a lot since, actually, is the fact that using new technologies, actually doing new things generally, you can find yourself in quite a discomforting position because you're doing things that are against the norm. And so therefore, you do run the risk of looking extremely silly, as anybody who's worn a virtual reality headset in front of other people will well know, or anybody who has seen somebody wearing and using virtual reality whilst you're sitting there in the normal world. But the other thing was the kind of the dehumanising of the transaction, to go from the handing over of money to somebody and for them to take the money and then to be able to count out the change and to be able to give back the right amount to you, and then you being able to leave an amount in the tip tray to be able to... All that's gone because of, you know, tippity tap with the watch or the phone or whatever else. And that's a little bit, I guess, of an intro into what it is that you have been writing about in your new book, The Human Experience, which is about customer experience. But at the core of what you're saying is it's only about people, really, isn't it? It's not about technology. It's not about, you know, removing people from the equation. It's not like going into a McDonald's these days and there you don't have to talk to see or do anything. You just tippity-tap on a screen and tippity-tap with your watch and you can leave without having any contact with people, really, other than somebody just chucking a bag at you.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Matt, I'm loving how old and grumpy you're sounding.
Thank you.
At the moment, the reference to the tippity-tap and these new things.
Well, to be fair, if you want old and grumpy... Catch the shows from about 2 years ago if you weren't really old and grumpy. I'm really sweetness and light these days. that is the core of your argument, really, isn't it? It's about where, if you want to provide great service for people, you need to think about people as people on both sides of the equation.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's about humanity rather than humans. But to deliver that humanity, you need to understand people. And I think what I find at the moment, and I'll come back to the Apple Watch in a second, but over the past 20 years, I think organizations have really spent a lot of time and effort trying to perfect the functional customer experience, but at the expense of the emotional human experience. And it's great. We can do more things in more ways than ever before. There's clearly a huge amount of improvements that have come through technology and mobile technology and being able to do things online. But organizations have seen that as an opportunity to cut costs, reduce costs, and they've lost sight of actually how they make people feel. And despite all of those improvements in the functional technology, people are no happier than they were with the experience they're getting 20 years ago. And there's an element of that that's about expectations changing, of course. But generally, we did a study, and this study has only just been published, and not many people have heard about this. We did a study last week to go with the book launch, and 85% of people that we surveyed said that they felt organizations were impersonal, lacking a human touch. 83% said they thought organizations were taking customers for granted. 81% said they thought organizations were more interested in cutting costs than providing a great experience. And these are really worrying figures, unless you happen to have a book out on the topic, in which case they're brilliant, frankly. They're exactly as you want. So I think, and that does lead to organizations that are full of humans that aren't allowed to act in a human way. I think the Apple Watch example is interesting because you're right. I remember that. And I remember feeling, I think it was like the first or second day I'd had it and I was playing with it. I remember feeling like, I'm either like the coolest guy in the room or I'm just a complete wanker like this. And seeing this sense of like wonder, I felt quite cool, like quite childlike, I think, you would say to do that. And actually seeing people's reaction is quite cool. But there's a couple of big problems with it. One is if it doesn't work, if you're there, like I've got this new technology and you're tapping and it doesn't work, you feel like such an idiot. But the other thing is the social cues, the human cues. And this is something that we're starting to lose quite a lot. You mentioned in your introduction about kind of giving tips and the handing over and the social element of that. And that's right. But there's also the social cues of I'm ready to pay. So you see this now in restaurants when they bring the bill over and you used to put your card down. And that was the symbol. I'm ready to pay now. And you bring the card. And we know how this works. Or I put the cash down. And now what do you do now? You put your phone on, like, okay, you can put your phone or you can say I'm paying with my card. But I have these odd situations still now where I'll go to pay for a sandwich and I'll just stand there because I know I've tapped my button on my watch to get it ready to pay. And the other person's just looking at me. And so there's all these social cues. And that's what I mean. When we're building new technology, you need to retain that humanity and that understanding of how people work to then make your products and services, even if they're solely digital, make them still work in a human environment and allow people to feel good using them.
And those secondary things that aren't really thought of, it's a slightly different example from a colleague of mine, Tony Phillips, talking about how he'd noticed that in train stations about 10 years or so ago, they got rid of all of the rolly clickety. I'm doing a lot of onomatopoeic stuff tonight. The clickety clack, those boards, those fabulous things. You still see them, I think, sometimes in European stations. And what he'd noted was that in the days when you had the thing that made a lot of noise when it updated, you had an audio cue, which was completely unintentional, which meant that you didn't have to spend all your time looking at the screen. You could look up when the clacks came because you knew that there was some new information coming. Whereas the digital ones, there's no audio signal for it at all. And so therefore you have to look at the screen all the time to be able to see the updating information. The making it efficient and better and more data has actually made it less usable. And it was all accidental.
Yeah. And that's true in so parts of customer experience and just human experience, really, which is a lot about effort, actually, and the friction. I think, actually, you might have been the person that tweeted this, Matt, about, sometimes you want friction. Like if you're on a bicycle, you want friction on the brakes. And I use that example a lot because I think that's right. There is such a need for good friction to feel like, if you're with a bank, for example, you want to know that there's some things that are going to stop anyone picking up your card and using it. Like you need some friction in some places that help you to understand things, but also help you to understand the value of things. And a lot of organizations, I think, have accidentally become very commoditized because they've stripped away so much of what made them unique and personal. And now what they offer is pretty much the same as everyone else. And so it's so easy to switch. You don't even start to think about who you're going to go with now. So there is a need to kind of build some of this friction in, whether it's examples like you say that act as cues for customers, or whether it's just to show the value of what you do over other organizations and why that matters.
Maybe I'm going to do a devil's advocate thing here, because I hear all that and I completely, you know, I buy into it, right? But let me just offer a counterpoint. For quite a long time now, if you call, I don't know, a service, maybe it's your, especially if it's like a comms provider or telephone company or whatever, you'll get a message on the telephone that says, we are experiencing a higher than usual level of activity. Please bear with us. And they seem to, it goes back to during the pandemic when you know, lots of people in call centers were off, or they had to close call centers or whatever. And it's kind of, yeah, well, you know, bear with us because you, and, but you know, right, that people have now been saying, oh yes, it's higher than usual activity, and it isn't, right? Because it's the usual activity, and there are things like, you know, unexpected item in the bagging area and all those supermarkets that are replacing more and more checkouts with automated checkouts, even though the studies would suggest that people prefer to deal with a person, and absolutely they do, no doubt, I think that's true. These things are still there annoying us, and you know, we kind of use them begrudgingly and breath. But where is the competitor that is doing all this stuff well and therefore taking all the customers? I haven't seen one. So if it's that important and it really makes a difference, where's the competition? Where's the bank or the telephone company with good customer service? Where's the supermarket with the checkout people?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there are. I mean, so if you're honest, so funnily enough, a couple of weeks ago, there's a Dutch supermarket that's just announced it's going to, what it called the slow lane, you know, going to start to kind of have a lane for people that just want to go and speak to people. I think that was interesting framing. I don't really think it's the slow lane, and you know, and they made it about vulnerable customers. I don't think it's that at all. I think it's just, if you feel you've got time and you want to chat, then it's great to have it. And if not, it's not. I think a good example actually is one of the ones I talk about in the book. And I wonder how often I'll mutter that phrase in the next half an hour, but it's Octopus Energy. You know, if you look at kind of the energy industry, you know, very kind of, you know, set in its ways, you know, lots of incumbents, very similar to the banking industry. And actually Octopus is absolutely flying. One of the case studies I've got, and they do so many interesting things that enable them to give a really, really great online functional service, but also have that really human service now. And you mentioned whole music, Chris, and I'm irritated beyond belief when I hear, you know, unexpectedly high call volumes, because you should be able to run the business to know. Now, what Octopus do, because sometimes they have people on hold, but if you're on hold with Octopus, they play the song that was number one when you were 14. So they've kind of built an API that connects to Spotify. They know your date of birth. They know that roughly 14, 15 is the age where most people kind of really get into music. That's your formative years. And this idea just came from what they call a Friday night dinner, when they get just everyone from the company on the call, and they used to talk about, what do you hear a lot that was annoying you this week? And someone said, well, the customers are complaining a lot about being on hold and the hold music. They hate our hold music. And an engineer said, you know, well, why don't we, you know, play music that they'd like? And someone else said, well, we could like play music at this certain age. And this idea basically was spun up in 20 minutes on this call. They had it live within a week to test. And it's just a really nice human touch. You can't always stop people being on hold. Sometimes that's a reality of the business. But showing that bit of human understanding and just doing something a little bit different just makes it a bit more of a pleasant experience. And so Octopus, I think, are a great example of a company that are doing this and are now flying. I think they're up to maybe the fourth biggest energy company now. They've just taken on all of Bulb's customers. They're the absolute darling of the energy industry by really doing the ante of what all the other energy companies have done.
Within the book, you've got a number of examples of companies that you use as sort of case examples of people providing interesting or good human-centered service. There was a list of companies that you said they do it, but they're so well covered, everybody else has talked about them.
Yeah.
Just a few examples of those companies, because I think it's useful, because there are those. It's also like in, you know, design thinking. There are certain companies that are rolled out again and again and again in every book. And you go, oh, God, not, you know, Patagonia again, or...
Yeah. Yeah.
So who are the ones that you excluded because they're too common?
Well, Patagonia was one. I mean, you're testing how well I know my own book now. But people like John Lewis, Amazon, I think I had Southwest Airlines, Zappos, you know, those kind of companies that just come up time and time again in these kind of studies where everyone always talks about Apple and Amazon and everyone talks about Zappos and we all know the stories from there. And Southwest Airlines have got this incredible culture that they're going to have. John Lewis, First Direct was another one in the UK. You know, these are all great companies. Funnily enough, actually, two or three of the companies I've named are starting to go backwards quite rapidly. But the case studies are so well known. And actually, I don't think there would have been benefit and we would have learned any more from me writing about them. I also think the companies I picked are slightly different shapes and size companies. And someone like Octopus that's a bit newer in, a city mapper that's in a slightly different world. You know, I was keen deliberately to have a couple of companies that were digital only to prove the point that you can be human without having humans. And city mapper was one of those. So, yeah, it was companies like those that I thought there's plenty on the internet already about them.
And then with the structure of the book, one of the things that you do quite early on is to tackle three myths that you think have evolved around, you know, the delivery of good customer experience and good customer service. Can we dig into those a wee bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what was interesting is these myths actually came at the end of the writing, even though they're at the start of the book. Because I found as I was writing the book and I was understanding more about the companies that are covered through my work, so I'm a consultant and I do, you know, work with companies to be customer-led for a living, I started to realize the big differences between the companies I was studying and a lot of those that I maybe work with on a daily basis. So I've got these three myths, and that's the myth of loyalty, the myth of customer feedback, and the myth of return on investment. Loyalty is the one that always, you know, makes people prick their ears up because there's such a belief around customer loyalty, and I just think it's a complete myth. I just don't think customers are loyal at all. I think we're loyal to very few things as humans: friends, family, football teams. Probably they're all things that we stick with through thick and thin. They're often very people based, and often they're things we haven't chosen. Actually, particularly in the case of family and football, you tend to kind of feel like, you know, well, that was chosen for me. But when it comes to organisations, now people might shop with a company very often and for a very long time. But I would always contend that if that organization tripled their prices and halved their quality overnight, you'd probably stop going there. And that's because they stopped being useful. And I think what we're talking about is usefulness rather than loyalty necessarily. And that's even true for something like Apple, which arguably has reduced its quality and its prices are still really high. But I think the usefulness with Apple is more around status. And, you know, if you're someone that wants to queue up to get the first iPhone, that's because it's a status thing. It shows who you are. And as soon as Apple stops becoming cool, those people will go as well. Now, this is dangerous. It sounds frivolous, but this is dangerous because in a world where organizations believe that customers are loyal, that then drives their behavior and their approach to customers. So they start focusing a lot more on onboarding and bringing customers on and then think, well, once they're with us, they're going to stay with us. And so they don't focus as much then on the ongoing service and particularly the end. A guy called Joe McLeod wrote a brilliant book called Ends about the endings. So I think it's dangerous for companies to assume that customers are loyal because they stop trying. And I think realizing that you have to keep winning customers is really important. And then the other myth I think worth talking about in slightly more detail is this myth of customer feedback, because I think we share a frustration on this. You know, organizations have never had more data about customers coming into the company. You know, there's more, you know, we live in this kind of epidemic of survey requests at the moment. You can't have any kind of experience without being asked what you thought about it. And that persuades senior leaders that they're close to what matters to customers because they're surrounded by this real-time data all the time. I talk about this thing called the thick end of the wedge in the book. And the problem is all of that data that's coming in is all at the thin end of the wedge. It's, you know, all about the company. It's very inside out. What do you think about us? What do you think about our service? What do you think about our product? Would you recommend us? Whereas actually to stay really useful to customers and to really understand customers, you need to get to the thick end of the wedge. You need to understand, well, actually, tell me about you and your life and the challenges and your ambitions and the problems you've got at the moment, the things that are getting in the way, you know, and what are the services you're using to help? And how can we be useful to you there? You know, you can get further up, and how can we be useful to you up there? So what this does, all this feedback coming in, as I say, it persuades leaders that they're close to customers. And what it stops leaders doing is actually going out and being close to customers, is actually going to spend time with real people in their houses, going shopping with real people, you know, just living, you know, going to experience the life in their life. And all of the companies I spoke to did this brilliantly. But it's a dangerous myth. So I think those two myths and the myth of return on investment are three things that if organizations believe those, it stops them being ambitious, it stops them trying to get close to customers. It stops them understanding that bad customer experience is expensive to provide rather than needing to prove the ROI on initiatives.
And that idea of that sort of thick end of the wedge, that also feels to me like the thin edge is the stuff that is nicely quantitative and gives you a nice, neat dashboard and gives you the ability to be able to say that 70% of our people or our customers this month said that they would recommend us to a friend.
Yeah.
We'll get it 75% next year. But the what is the lived experience of the customer isn't something you can stick on a dashboard. It isn't something that can give, you know, succor to the attention span of the average chief executive, which appears to be about 3.5 seconds.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, we often warn against obsessing over a single number. We find a lot of organizations end up taking quite a transactional approach to customer experience. And one of the hallmarks of that is you obsess over the number rather than obsessing over your customers. And the number becomes the thing. But of course, the number is only, you know, first of all, it's an average broadly, which is useless anyway. But secondly, it you know, only looks at part of your experience. It doesn't look at all of your experience. And those figures don't really move very much. I mean, I quote the Institute of Customer Service in the book, because I've written a book, in case I haven't mentioned that. And it's really interesting. So the ICS report has been going for, I think, 12 years now. And if you look in 2013, it was 76.7%. And if you look in 2023, I think it's like 77.7. And over time, the way they show the graph is between the scores 65 and 80. So the graph looks, you know, up and down, up and down. But if you make that scale 0 to 100, it's basically just a straight line, because there's no, look at the way you're asking the questions and what you're finding out. And so I think that's right. Those dashboards come out, everyone can look through them. But it really just saves them the effort of actually going to spend time with customers. And again, the companies I spoke to, and I'll give an example, Chiltern Railways, they make sure that their senior managers live on the Chiltern Railways line. So they have to use their own service every day, and they have to wear their name badges when they're on their service. So every day they're experiencing what their customers are experiencing. And Alan Riley, who was of customer services there, he had a great quote. He said to me, you know, Johnny, said, I always found that the more formal the forum, the less I got out of it. So focus groups, meet the manager events, never really got much from those. But spending half an hour on a delayed train on the way into Marylebone at 7:38 in the morning, yeah, I learned a lot then.
That's a bit, there's something in your book about the lie theory, which is similar to that, where when the chief exec asks if, or comes up with an idea where he says it's great, and when they ask how it's going, they all say, oh, it's going okay, because nobody really wants to give anybody bad news. And as you say, that there is a reluctance to give bad news, right? There was something, you know, that book that, what's his name, Prince Harry released recently, and there's the picture of him in the front. And the joke was, you know, at the exit interview, it's like, yeah, I've loved working here, and it's been great. And then on Glassdoor, you've got the picture of Prince Harry, you know, and his list of things. And people do tend to go to those. When you're talking to people in certain formats, you're not necessarily going to get the truth. It's a question of a lot of the data we gather, doesn't it? Because there's very little point in gathering the data if it's all it's going to do is reinforce your preconceptions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, yeah, I'm hoping my book is, say, half as successful as Prince Harry's. I'll take that. But yeah, you're right. And it was my friend Mark Johnson. You've articulated well with the lie theory. He's kind of a hometown prophet guy. And he told me this theory over a beer one night about a decade ago. And I've always remembered it. I thought it was brilliant how organisations work. But you're right. I mean, I think the thing with understanding customers at any level is there is no such thing as the truth. You know, there is no one truth, partly because customers don't know what they feel and what they believe and how they react. So even if you're sat down asking them in their house, they're still going to give you their version of the truth. One of the stories I tell you is about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I was doing a project with one of the big food manufacturers. And it was about ready meals, the future of convenience food, what did ready meals look like in the future? And so as part of this, I went to interview a whole load of customers, a whole load of people. And we was interviewing them in their homes, then going shopping with them. And I went to interview this lady. And I said she was 41. And she was very fit and healthy. She was really into yoga. She said that she cooked everything from scratch. and that she cooking really mattered to her. And this checked out. I was in her kitchen having this conversation, surrounded by recipe books, surrounded by spices and herbs. And she said, you know, I would never touch ready meals and convenience food. It's just not for me. So checks out. An hour later, we're going to Waitrose and we're going up and down the aisle. And we get to the ready meal aisle, the prepared food aisle. And I think, well, we're going to fly down here. And about halfway down, she stops and she picks up a ready-made mashed potato and throws that in. So I won't say anything yet. And then a little bit further down, she picks up a ready-chopped onion and a ready-chopped carrot. And she throws that in. And I said, well, hang on. I said, how does this work with what you were telling me before? And she looked at me like I was crazy. And she said, well, I'm busy. I haven't got time to, like, peel and chop my own vegetables. And she just, like, completely discounted this in the story she was telling. Now, then we got to the confectionery aisle and the alcohol aisle. And again, I thought, well, we're not going to go anywhere near here because, you know, super healthy, et cetera, don't drink, whatever. And she just, I mean, she sweeps in a load of chocolate and a load of wine, like proper armful into the trolley. And I can't remember her name, actually. But I said, hang on, what's it? And she said, well, that's for girls' night on a Friday night. That doesn't count. Like she just said, that doesn't count. And it was a brilliant example of how customers tell you the version of themselves that they want you to know, they want you to see. And so, and that's true with any data, whether it's, you know, and so you have to be there to observe. You have to spot the hypocrisies. You have to spot the contradictions, because it's only in doing that you really understand what's going on with people in a way that even they don't understand. And what we tend to find, Chris, is that, and this is more in our work, we get CEOs and executives to go and do this, to go and do this immersion themselves. Because if you just take the results and put them on a PowerPoint slide and put them in front of them as a group, people would rather question the methodology than accept the inconvenient truth. And so straight away you get, you know, well, how big was the sample size? Was it the right people? And was it this one? But when they're there, they might not like what they see, but they can't deny it's true, in inverted commas. They can't deny it's real and it's happening, even if it's not statistically significant. And that's really what's at the heart of so many customer-led organizations, is an acceptance to seek out and find the inconvenient truths and do something about them, as opposed to a defensiveness of not wanting to accept what's there.
What do you think? I mean, I've seen this kind of thing in action in a number of organizations, but what I've also seen is a huge reticence to go anywhere near customers often. And there's a real fear that, and I can't quite work out, is it a fear of, you know, being shouted at? Is it a fear of what you might discover? Is it a fear of just people generally? Because to get to the top of an organisation, you need mannerisms and characteristics that are not necessarily the sort of thing that means you would be wanted to be put in front of a customer, even a human being in some cases. Yeah. And what's your take on that? What are the barriers that people who are resistant to doing that have?
Yes, I mean, it's fascinating from our perspective. We quite often run these big immersion sessions where we maybe get, you know, 20 execs in a room and we bring in, as a surprise, like 10 or 15 customers, and they go white, you know, the fear of on their faces. And we have to spend a lot of time coaching them to have a conversation with people. And I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I do think it's a case of the kind of people that are in those kind of jobs. So I used to be at HSBC for 12 years, and I started out in the branches, frontline, every single day meeting other people. And I've always been really comfortable with that, having conversations. I love it. I thrive off meeting people. And then I went to and I was surrounded by people that were exactly the same as me. And then I went to work in head office in Canary Wharf, and I was the odd one out. Like, you know, I was the one that ended up running all the workshops and the events, because I was the odd one out. You know, other people wanted to be head down. Let's do a spreadsheet. Let's do our emails. Let's have like conversation. Lovely people, all people that are trying to do the right thing for customers, but they just got a slightly different profile, slightly different psychology. And so they're not in customer facing roles, and they've chosen that as their career for whatever number of reasons. So I try not to be too harsh actually on people in that situation, because we are all different. And then when you overlay that onto the fact that they then don't do it very often, that then just means that actually, you know, when someone like me turns up and I say, oh, you're going to come and meet this person you've never met before, I'm going to sit you down, you're going to have an hour's conversation with them. To be fair, you know, if you put anyone in a pub and said, go and speak to that person for an hour, just go and find out about them and their life, quite a lot of people probably wouldn't be comfortable with that. My answer to that is do it more. do it more. If you're executives in an organization, that should be every single week, part of your week should be, I'm going to go and speak to some customers in whatever way. And then practice makes perfect, and you get used to it, even if it does make you uncomfortable.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually. One of the things I've observed with the CEO at my current place is he's actually, the two founders, one of them is complete gregarious, you know, the center of the social, he's, you know, a party animal. He's at an age where he really should calm down a bit, quite frankly, Ryan, if you're listening. But the other founder is actually quite reserved, quite quiet. It feels actually quite introverted, but in that way that introverts who are able to be on stage. So he can do the stage thing really well and he can be in an audience, but it's not his natural thing. But he goes out really regularly. He has long conversations with clients and then he publishes across the whole company what he finds. Warts and all. And I've never seen anything quite like that. And it's surprising, actually, because as a personality type, you would probably think that he would be much like many other senior people, that they wouldn't want to go anywhere near that. But he you know, really relishes it. It's unusual, isn't it?
Well, it's a really great example to set that. And also, I mean, I think there's an element of how you frame this. So, you know, if you frame it as you just got to go out and speak to people, I think people worry about that. But if you frame it as it's kind of almost a process, a part of your job, and actually I think the really clever part you've mentioned there, and I don't know how much it makes a difference, but the fact there's a purpose to it, which is publishing it for the rest of the organization, I think changes it slightly, because I think it's part of a process that's getting you to a defined place, as opposed to I'm just going to have the conversation. And we do often get asked that. We say, we're going to have these conversations, but what comes from it? So I think having a reason and a purpose why you're doing it, and a commitment to the organization that you're doing it, I think maybe helps the psychology of that a little bit, and helps make it more comfortable for people to do it as a responsibility of their job role.
So we've talked a fair bit about the things that are problematic and the myths and some of the challenges. You obviously don't have a solution for everything, but you have within the book tried to be able to identify characteristics of what might work, characteristics of the way in which organizations that you see as exemplars in this are doing things, and what other people might learn from that in terms of, you know, what do we do, John, what is it that we should be looking to do differently or looking to build on?
Yeah, I mean, my wife would tell you I do think I have an answer to everything, but my wife would also be right that I do not. Yeah, that's right. So I kind of talk in the book about what I call enablers and behaviours. And actually, right at the start of writing the book, I was really keen that it wasn't another framework, that it wasn't another list of, well, here's the seven things that's true for everything. Because customer experience is full of those, and proposition design strategy is full of those. And I don't really believe things fit that neatly into boxes. However, having said that, I do have five enablers and seven behaviours. And these came from interviewing these CEOs and CMOs of companies that I think do this really well. And particularly on the enablers, what was really clear was they all shared these same ways of working. They all did other things as well that were good, but they all did these five things. And I thought that was really interesting. And you know, so they all had kind of real ambition. Actually, not many of them had a customer experience strategy, which is slightly awkward for me as someone that gets paid to do customer experience strategies for a living, just because inherently they had the ambition to want to be great for customers. They're all deeply connected to customers, as we've talked about. They all had real focus on the few moments that mattered. They weren't trying to be all things to all people. They knew the moments that mattered and would focus on making those brilliant. They all had an outside-in perspective. They were looking at other industries for inspiration and comparison, not just trying to be, you know, top three in their own industry. And they also, and it's worth pausing on this one, they also had real empowerment in the organization. Their colleagues had real freedom to make the right decisions and do the right things for customers. I think this is really, really crucial when you're looking at how to create a human experience, because as we said at the start, organizations are full of humans that aren't allowed to act in a human way. They're kind of restricted by process. And the easiest thing to do actually is to release those shackles a bit and let people, you don't need to teach people how to be empathetic. You just need to let them be empathetic in the way that they would be if they're in a pub with friends and family. AO.com is a great example of this. They're a, you know, they kind of white goods retailer based up in Manchester. And John Roberts is their CEO and their founder. And there was a couple of interesting things with them. So he's really, really focused on this kind of empowerment. And he talks about mums and grands. That's their customer experience strategy, mums and grands. And he says, basically, treat people the way you would want people to treat your gran if they were delivering a fridge to them. And make decisions that you would be proud to tell your mum about over dinner when you get home. And it's that simple. And you can see how it works. There's a great story they tell, great anecdote of a driver that was going to deliver a fridge to this couple. And he phoned them up. You know, you get your phone call half an hour before, said, I'm on the way, be with you in half an hour. And the customer's son answered the phone and said, oh, that's fine. We're just to let you know, it's a bit busy because it's my parents' wedding anniversary today. So yeah, no worries. So on the way, the driver just decides to stop at a local florist, buy a pot plant in AO.com green and white, which is quite easy if it's popular, if it's that colours. Gets to the customer's house, knocks on the door. Hi, I'm so-and-so from AO.com. Here's the fridge. And by the way, happy wedding anniversary. And here's a pot plant. It's such a simple thing to do. And it's one of those stories and people go, yeah, but can you scale that? But actually, well, you can, because all that happened, there was no surprise and delight budget. There was no sign-off needed. There was no people asked. It wasn't a pre-prepared pot plant and they hadn't asked in advance, is it your wedding anniversary at the moment? It was just a human connection. Someone heard a bit of information, had the freedom to do something about it, made a decision that they'd be proud to tell their mum about, gave a pot plant to someone because that's probably what they want someone to do for their gran. And then you get great experiences. And if you let your people do that, those experiences just kind of come through. And your colleagues are much, much happier working for you as well. So that's what these enablers are, really, these ways of working, that if you can really start to embed those and challenge yourself on those as an organization, a lot of the behaviors they follow. They follow. I do think the behaviors I've listed are broadly the ones that I think do make a human experience, but whatever they end up being, they follow because you've got the right ways of working that allow that great experience to exist.
Fascinating. Thank you, John, for joining us on the show this week. That was you've got a book out, apparently.
I've got a book out. Have I mentioned it's available from all good bookstores and probably some bad ones too?
What has the week ahead got for Mr. Sill?
Do you know what? This week feels slightly calmer than last week. There's a few excellent podcasts like this. We've got a few press release things we're doing. But yeah, I've actually got a really interesting lunch on Friday as an organization. I don't think I mentioned I work for a company called The Foundation. And we've got together this group of people, 30 or so people that have been there and done it. They're kind of, you know, have been in organizations and create real customer-led success. So we're hosting a lunch for all of them to come, and I'm going to talk to them about the book. But that'll be really interesting because they're all people that have got real first-hand experience of having done this. So looking forward to that, and then looking forward to a weekend of coaching my son's football team and immediately being brought back down to earth from any false sense of celebrity I've created for myself in the last week.
Excellent. Chris, what about you? What's your 7 days ahead looking like?
Well, a little bit quieter, to be honest. I'm off to Worcester on Friday to go and see some of the have a chat, and that would be nice. But I think actually it's going to be a quieter few days. So I'm looking forward to getting some work done and just getting back into a normal routine. How about you?
Well, it's half term next week, so we've actually got a bit of a break. And as we do for the show as well, there won't be a show next week. We, as a family, the eldest is going off on a school trip, so the youngest and me and the missus are going to go to Barcelona for a few days. The last time I looked, the weather is going to be sunny and 16 degrees, which would be quite nice. And youngest has become a little bit obsessed with architecture, so wants to go and see the Gaudi stuff. So do a bit of that. Might see if I take him to see the Nou Camp Stadium. Might go up the coast a bit, see some of the other towns around Barcelona as well. So that should be good.
Very nice.
Jolly good.
Yeah, no, looking forward to it. It's one of my favourite cities actually in Europe. I've been quite a few times and it's a wonderful place, Barcelona. So that'd be good. Anyway, so we won't be here next week. We will be back the week after. We will continue into the cavalcade of guests that you've come to expect and love. We're also starting to plot to do something of a listener survey. We won't be asking the likelihood of you recommending us to somebody else. You'll be pleased to ask. But we've been thinking, Chris and I, about what we might do to be able to continue to keep the show fresh and useful and entertaining. And so we want to be able to get some feedback from our beloved listeners, which includes you. And so we're going to do a little bit of planning on that over the next couple of weeks. So keep an eye and ear out for how you can help us to be able to make sure that we are doing something that keeps us entertained, but keeps you entertained and informed as well. So there we go. Anyway, before we go, John, how likely are you to recommend WB-40 to somebody else?
Oh, 10 out of 10. Absolutely, absolutely recommend, if this is a hypothetical question.
It's absolutely hypothetical. Thank you for joining us. We'll put a link to your book on the website at wb40podcast.com. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, and we'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, and on all good podcasting platforms.